loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we'll talk to Dr. Gerald Horn about two important issues: the ongoing government shutdown over Trump's border wall, and the inauguration today of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, who begins his second term under intense pressure from the United States and its allies. We're going to talk about the wall, U.S. immigration policy, and U.S. foreign policy as it relates to Latin America. And then we continue our weekly series called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump said today that he will, quote, almost definitely, unquote, declare a national emergency soon to secure funding for his border wall. He made the comment as he departed today to Texas to meet with Customs and Border Patrol officials and to continue making the case for hardline anti-immigrant policies. Next, the U.S. has accused Russia's Kaspersky lab of working with Russian spies on cyber warfare. But Politico is reporting that Kaspersky actually helped catch an NSA data thief, even though the U.S. had completely missed the theft. Then, the New York Times today issued a correction, a retraction would be more appropriate, to a front-page story yesterday saying that former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort had shared polling data with a Russian contact for passage to a Russian oligarch. That information was not true. Manafort had shared the information for passage to two Ukrainian politicians with whom he had had a business relationship. The true story undercuts any accusation of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. And then it's time again for our weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. And finally, the UK's departure from the European Union is fast approaching. The British Parliament is now conducting the official debate on the Brexit deal ahead of a vote next week. But Prime Minister Theresa may not have the votes necessary to pass the terms of the deal, and was dealt a blow when members of her own Conservative Party revolted to help pass a motion limiting her options in the event that the deal is rejected. And in other headlines, blaming the government shutdown on the border wall debate, President Trump tweeted today, quote, I am respectfully canceling my very important trip to Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Forum, unquote. The Davos Forum will be held from January 21st to the 25th, and Trump had been expected to make a short appearance. Congolese opposition candidate Felix Tshisekedi was declared the winner of the recent presidential election. The election was delayed multiple times in what the opposition characterized as a last-ditch attempt by outgoing President Kabila to hold on to power. Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State, will speak at a fundraiser in New Hampshire to be held later this month, a sign that he is seriously considering a run for president. The fundraiser is to benefit the League of Conservation Voters. Inslee will also hold events the following day in the state. Following the substance's legalization, Canadian cannabis prices went up 17.4%, according to Statistics Canada, in an analysis that gathered data equally from legal and illegal sales. However, sales from the underground economy were more than double the quantity of legal sales. Notably, the availability of legalized cannabis has been limited, with the market seeing shortages since its legalization in October. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to a review of U.S. domestic and international politics. President Trump is heading to the border today to speak with the Customs and Border Patrol officials about the so-called crisis, I'm using air quotes, even though the same officials aren't being paid because of the government shutdown. Meanwhile, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro was sworn in today for a new term as the U.S.-backed regime change effort targeting his government continues. And Brazil's new president, Bolsonaro, moved today to withdraw his country from the UN Global Migration Pact. We're joined in studio by Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn is a professor of history at the University of Houston, the author of many, many books, including Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, and The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and capitalism in 17th century North America and the Caribbean. Dr. Horn, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Donald Trump gave a press talk, impromptu press talk, before heading to the border to deal with the crisis. He said, He was almost definitely...
He was probably almost definitely going to declare an emergency.
Yeah.
Probably.
Okay. Dr. Horn, go ahead.
Well, with regard to this alleged crisis at the U.S. border, in many ways it represents chickens coming home to roost. First of all, with regard to U.S. foreign policy, we all know that, for example, in 1954, the United States helped to engineer the overthrow of the Arbenz government in Guatemala, which helped to destabilize that regime and that country for decades to come. The Guatemalans, of course, are part of the refugee flow into Southern California and Northern Mexico. We all know that in the 1980s, the Reagan administration fought a bitter war in El Salvador against the Farabundo Marti National Liberation Front and helped to engineer a culture of violence, which caused many people to flee, particularly youth who wound up in Southern California, where they became acquainted with the gang culture, which led directly to this so-called MS-13 that Mr. Trump makes such a big to-do about. And we all know that Honduras, in order to destabilize the Sandinista regime in the 1980s in neighboring Nicaragua, the United States turned Honduras into a virtual military base. Of course, in all of these Central American countries, there were attempts to prevent the redistribution of wealth to alleviate poverty, helping to create even more poor people than had existed previously. And this also helps to perpetuate the refugee flow northward. But rather than deal with that, Mr. Trump, of course, rails against poor people. But it's also chickens coming home to roost, I'm afraid to say, in terms of what might be this impending invocation of emergency powers, the establishment of a state of emergency, which would allow Mr. Trump to do an end run around Congress, a very dangerous president, I might add, because with his dictatorial and bullying tendencies, he might decide to do an end run around the other two co-equal branches of government in order to suppress and repress civil liberties. And of course, there are a number of emergency decrees that have been put in place by previous U.S. presidents, most of which have dealt with foreign actors, for example, Venezuelans in particular. But because there was not sufficient outcry against those particular proclamations and decrees, now we find, that is to say the people in the United States, that we may become the ultimate victims of these phony states of emergency. And I think that obviously we need a massive outcry against what might be down the pike.
Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. I think those are two important branches of this discussion. One is chickens coming home to roost. You have U.S. Foreign policy, again, specifically towards Latin America and towards Central America, helping to create greater poverty. I'm reminded about Walter Rodney's book, how Europe underdeveloped Africa. It wasn't just that Africa was underdeveloped and Europe was developed. European colonialism and European imperialism, European capitalism underdeveloped Africa. In many ways, the United States and U.S. empire and U.S. imperialism has underdeveloped Latin America, not only by its economic policies, but as you're talking about, Dr. Horn, a direct political interventions, the overthrow of Arbenz in 1954, the intervention in El Salvador, the intervention against the Nicaraguans using Honduras as a military base, all of that. And then the second element that you've brought to light, which is the crisis of democracy, which is the use of executive authority to do almost anything. And so the traditional constitutional levers that are granted to Congress, the power to declare war and the power of the purse for funding, essentially both taken away under these same sort of aegis. Again, the intersection of two very, very important issues.
Well, it's not only that, but it's also how U.S. foreign policy backfires. I'm reminded that in 1954, when the Arbenz regime was overthrown with the CIA's direct assistance, an Argentine doctor by the name of Ernesto Che Guevara happened to be passing through Guatemala at that precise moment. It was a very radicalizing event in his tumultuous life. And of course, he winds up in Mexico, where he encounters Fidel Castro, and the rest is history. particularly in 1959, the triumph of the Cuban Revolution, whose anniversary we're marking this month. But with regard to the second point, I'm also reminded of a very ominous precedent, that is to say the Korematsu case from the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1940s, where fundamentally what was rendered was that it was legitimate and legal to intern those of Japanese ancestry, not because they had created some volitional act, but because precisely they were of Japanese ancestry. It was said at the time by U.S. Supreme Court Justice that the emergency powers, which helped to undergird that particular ominous decision, was like a loaded weapon in the Oval Office. And now that loaded weapon in the Oval Office has been picked up by an addled, demented 45th U.S. president with consequences too ghastly to contemplate.
Very, very important. And again, we see the aggregation of executive authority over and over and over again. And each time, if it's the Democrats in power, then they think, well, this is okay because it's our guy. Or if the Republicans are in power, it's our guy. But then ultimately, this power never dissolves. It doesn't dissipate once assumed. Once assumed, it becomes greater and greater power. And I remember, John, and you and I have talked about this, Tommy Franks, General Tommy Franks, after the 2003 invasion of Iraq, and I think he had just retired, made the case that if there was another terrorist attack in the United States, one that used even greater weapons than were used on 2001, he could see the suspension of civil liberties. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, here's a U.S. general, a top U.S. general saying, yeah, we're ready. We would be ready. Matter of fact, it's almost inevitable that there could be martial law. All we need is a terrorist action. Well, a terrorist action, anybody can do, set off a bomb.
Or anything could happen, and then you have some politician calling it a terrorist action as a trigger. If a policy decision is made to suspend civil liberties, and somebody wants to do that badly enough, they can make up any excuse to suspend those civil liberties. And that's the day we cease becoming America in any possible way.
Well, yeah, and Dr. Horn, if you think that Trump is able to make this bogus argument that this is a national emergency, we know migration is in fact down, undocumented workers coming across the border is at the lowest level it's been in 1972. This is obviously a bogus thing. So if he can do it and gets away with it, and the Democrats might actually feel fine about it because then the government can reopen, both sides stay true to their principles, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah.
Both declare victory.
Yeah, then it's another precedent-setting act.
And obviously, it's rather dangerous to rely upon the judiciary to overturn any misguided opinions and executive actions by Mr. Trump, since we know that a top priority of Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has been packing the courts, which he has done rather successfully, most recently and most dangerously with Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm not one who's persuaded by this idea that Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice John Roberts is now taking this role as a centrist to balance the right-wing faction led by Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. And then I think we need to contemplate and consider more carefully what a historian once called this rise of the imperial presidency, where the Oval Office and the executive authority has aggregated more authority and power to itself. We see this particularly with regard to the Declaration of War and Peace. We know that the Constitution supposedly allocates the ability to make a declaration of war to Congress, but obviously that has not been taking place. Either presidents have plunged in to countries like Mr. Trump did in 2017 when he bombed Syria without a declaration of war by the U.S. Congress. And we see it also in the withering of the War Powers Act, which was developed during the darkest days of the Nixon administration, but has been routinely ignored since. And once again, I'm afraid to say that because we have not been able to generate sufficient opposition to this kind of imperialism, it seems that we now, that is to say the people in the United States, are now on the chopping block.
Let's talk about Trump versus other presidents for a moment. We had, of course, the Bush presidency aggregating huge amounts of executive authority, passing waivers for its own actions. In other words, waiving and inoculating, immunizing the executive branch from its own laws. using phony legal decisions drafted by, well, I guess I don't know if they're phony lawyers, but they're lawyers who are doing the bidding of politicians in the executive office to legalize torture, which is clearly not legal. Of course, the invasion of Iraq itself. But then you had Barack Obama. Barack Obama, after 2000, when he came into office January 2009, also had this aggregation of power. You had the president sitting down with a kill list every Tuesday, I think it was, to decide who was going to be assassinated by drone attacks. And also lots of other things, including like the invasion of Libya, again, not authorized by Congress at all. You just think about it. This is what's wrong, where the liberal doesn't mean anything anymore. The Democrats attacking Trump as if he's the worst thing ever. And of course, you can make that argument with a lot of credibility. But at the same time, what the Democrats have been doing in office is hardly a fundamental difference. In fact, I would say continuity more than change actually is signified with the Trump administration.
Well, the latter point resonates with me, at least, because I think that we make a fundamental error when, understandably, perhaps, we seek to excoriate Mr. Trump to the point where we act as if he's outside of the train and the stream of U.S. history. And all you have to do is look at that picture on an evening or so ago when he gave his speech from the Oval Office. Looming above him was a picture of Andrew Jackson, his hero, a genocidaire, a man who's responsible for not only genocide against Native Americans, but ousting them from their homeland and what is now in the Southeast United States, telling them they could go to Oklahoma, which would be their new homeland as long as the rivers shall flow and the grass shall grow. And that, of course, is overturned like so many other promises and pledges to Native Americans. Then, of course, he was a slave trader as well. I think that in this attempt to cast Mr. Trump as beyond the pale, we forget the ugly history of the United States and how Mr. Trump fits right into that history. And with regard to Libya, I don't think anybody should ever forget how that phony case for regime change was ginned up by the 44th U.S. president, which not only led to the death of Muammar Gaddafi, but led to outright persecution against darker-skinned people in Libya, who were perceived to be the allies of the Gaddafi regime, not to mention those who had been fleeing from deeper into the continent into Libya for work and then found themselves in conditions of neo-slavery. It's rather ironic, indeed, that the first president of African descent was responsible for this kind of holocaust, which also, by the way, then led to a refugee crisis as people crossed the Mediterranean into Italy, which then Mr. Trump's comrades in Rome can then use to create conditions for the rise of this Salvini neo-fascist regime in Rome. But I think on a more positive note, we should pay very careful and close attention to what the new president of Mexico, López Obrador, has said, which is that if Washington is sincerely concerned about this refugee flow, Washington should be the main and prime backer of a New Deal in Central America, particularly in the Northern Triangle, where the borders of Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala meet, to create opportunity and jobs, because people do not want to leave their homes to come to this white supremacist citadel here in North America. They prefer to stay home. And Mr. López Obrador also added the note that if Washington is not interested, perhaps China and other nations will be interested. And perhaps that kind of message will resonate in Washington and help to create this New Deal for Central America, which I think would be to the benefit of us all.
Indeed. That's the voice of Dr. Gerald Horn. Professor Horn is joining us today in a discussion of both U.S. domestic politics and international politics. Since we're talking about Latin America, and we talked a little bit about Honduras and El Salvador, Guatemala, the coup in 1954, the CIA coup that toppled the Arbenz government. When Arbenz dared to nationalize the United Fruit Company to try to benefit the people of Guatemala, just as Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran tried to nationalize the Anglo-Iranian oil company, now known as BP, British Petroleum formerly. The U.S. and British intelligence overthrew Mossadegh and imposed a tyranny on Iran. We're talking about Latin America, though. Let's stay on Latin America. We have about, 9 minutes left in this segment. Nicolas Maduro sworn in today again as the head of state for Venezuela. What's your take?
As you know, his inauguration was greeted with tightened sanctions on behalf of the United States of America. Also, a declaration by a number of neighbors in this hemisphere, led by Canada, I'm afraid to say, to not recognize the Caracas regime. And in fact, if you read carefully, to destabilize it. I'm particularly disappointed in Canada, because you would think that the liberals under Mr. Trudeau in Ottawa would recognize that they're under the gun with this new turn in Washington towards the ultra-right with Mr. Trump. And that rather than tail after the Yankees with regard to trying to destabilize Caracas and Mr. Maduro, they'd be better off if they would do what Mexico has been doing. Mexico refused to join that declaration seeking to make the Maduro regime illegitimate, which I'm afraid to say will probably lead to further pressure on the regime in Mexico City, which we have to keep a careful eye on. And obviously, at the tip of the spear in terms of this anti-Caracas conspiracy will be the new regime in Brazil under Mr. Bolsonaro, which has already exposed what its predilections are when, even before getting inaugurated, Mr. Bolsonaro began to denounce Cuba, which led the Cuban government to withdraw the thousands of doctors they had sent to Brazil to serve the underserved, thousands upon thousands of doctors and medical workers, et cetera. The only good news with regard to Mr. Bolsonaro is that because he is bent and determined to follow Washington's line, this will probably lead to worsened relations with Brazil's major trading partner, which is China, which will probably cause worsened economic conditions that may lead to a premature exit from office of Mr. Bolsonaro. And speaking of premature exits, I would also encourage your audience to keep a careful eye on the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. I don't think it would make sense for those countries, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, to meet in the same room with an agent like Mr. Bolsonaro. So it would seem that the BRICS might become the RICS, which I think would be a step forward for humanity.
You know, getting back to, we just touched for a moment on Venezuela. One of the things that's interesting to me is how, despite the fact that there are 13 countries in the hemisphere that have launched this economic attack on Venezuela because of Nicolas Maduro's leadership, he's even more popular domestically than he was when he was first elected in that snap election in 2013. And it's because primarily he's maintained the support of the poor and he's maintained the support of the military. So despite the fact that the economy is in shambles, largely because of sanctions, he's as popular as ever, and I don't think he's going to go anywhere.
We also have to pay careful and close attention to the external environment. I noticed that Mr. Maduro has paid more than one visit to Turkey, for example, and that visit has been reciprocated by Mr. Erdogan as well. And with Turkey's deteriorating relations with Washington, we should pay careful note of that. I was also quite taken aback when the right-wing press almost went into hysterics when a Russian plane landed
I remember that.
In Venezuela. And obviously, the relations between Moscow and Caracas seemed to be promising. In fact, I noted that in press reports after Mr. Maduro's trip to Moscow just a few weeks ago, he came back saying that he had some of the most intriguing and important meetings of his entire life that took place in Moscow. But on a more sober note, we have to pay very careful and close attention to Venezuela's relations with its neighbor in Guyana. There are territorial claims that Venezuela has made on Guyana that precede the advent of either Hugo Chavez or Nicolas Maduro. Given the fact that major oil finds have been uncovered in Guyana and U.S. oil companies have made major investments there, that might be used as a lever to help to unseat, if you like, the Maduro regime. And so we have to prevail upon our friends in Guyana and Georgetown not to be used as tools for these kinds of subversive schemes.
Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. So we have diplomats from a dozen Latin American countries and Canada, the Lima Group, who have actually called for Maduro to give up power, to cede presidential power to the opposition, even though he won the election. I mean, it's amazing. And of course, Lopez Obrador was chastened, not chastened, but criticized by right-wingers in Latin America and by the United States for having invited Maduro to his inauguration. And López Obrador is going in a different direction. Mexico is a big country, a huge country, the third largest trading partner with the United States. So if, as you're suggesting, Dr. Horn, if it means a realignment or a reorientation from China, and of course, China is a Pacific power, but so are the West Coast of the Latin American countries, and so is Mexico. Again, the unintended consequences of hubris, the unintended consequences of overreach. Maduro, while what John said is true, yeah, there's a lot of dissatisfaction, a lot of human suffering, a lot of economic dislocation. But the Bolivarian process has been, you know, anchored in the poor, especially. And that's the majority. Again, unintended consequences. People are trying to present Venezuela and the Bolivarian process as a lost cause, that it's all just going to go downhill. But they're not quitting.
So to put it mildly, I'm glad you raised this question of Mexico, the largest Spanish-speaking country in the world, a country of 110 million, a country with very deep-seated hostility to U.S. imperialism, not least given the fact that the United States waged a war of aggression against Mexico 1846 to 1848, which patriotic Mexicans have yet to forget or forgive. And in that context, I've been very concerned about these recent press reports from Mexico City about this petroleum crisis. That is to say, even though it's a major petroleum producer, apparently you have cars lined up at the pump, not able to get their tanks filled or perhaps topping off their tanks. And it's apparent from U.S. press reports that this is going to be used as a kind of lever against the new regime in Mexico City, headed by López Obrador, to try to twist the arm of that regime to get it to join this so-called Lima group against Venezuela. And I would say now more than ever, our friends in Latin America need our support and solidarity.
Indeed, they do. And there's an organization, the Cuba-Venezuela Solidarity Committee. You can go online and find a Cuba-Venezuela Solidarity Committee, a group that some of us work with, because as Dr. Horn is pointing out, why should Latin America endure all of this wrath and punishment from a government that speaks in our name without the people of the United States standing up and saying what they do believe in? And if you believe that Venezuela and Latin America should have the right to determine their and its own destiny, you have to stand up and say no to the government bullying these countries. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined here in studio by Dr. Gerald Horn. He's a professor of history at the University of Houston. He's the author of many, many books. Dr. Horn, you're the most prolific author we know.
Without a doubt.
And I asked you before, how do you do it? How do you write so many books? And I think you said hard work and good living or something
like
that.
Clean living.
Clean living. Anyway, his books include Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. Another book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. And another book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in the 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you. Hi, thanks for having us.
Glad to do this again. There has been a lot in the news the past week. It's the good, the bad, and the ugly. We're going to try to get to all of it. Why don't we start with you, Paul? You have some news from the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's not very good.
Yes, unfortunately, since 2009, the Florida Department of Corrections has censored all issues of Prison Legal News, and they've censored all issues of Criminal Legal News since we started publishing it. And we lost our challenge at trial in 2015. The Court of Appeals upheld the censorship in earlier last year in May, and we sought review from the U.S. Supreme Court to hopefully reverse that and stop the censorship, and unfortunately they denied review. So as we go into 2019, it's been around 10 years of continuous censorship of prison legal news by the Florida Department of Corrections.
What have you done in other cases where you've had censorship? I recall censorship in, I think it was local jails in South Carolina, and you sued over that as well, and elsewhere around the country at different levels of the prison system.
Yes, we're pretty aggressive about vindicating our First Amendment rights and challenging censorship of our publications. We take the view that every prisoner in America should be able to get prison legal news and criminal legal news in the books that we distribute. And in fact, we have four staff attorneys who, not all, but a big chunk of their time is dedicated to ensuring that prisoners can receive our publications. And so, you know, we've been pretty good about consistently seeking to vindicate our rights. And for the most part, we're generally pretty successful. You know, well over a dozen states are under injunctions and consent decrees requiring the delivery of our books and magazines. And yeah, unfortunately, this is the first one. This is our first statewide censorship case that we've lost. So, and yeah, this is also the context, too, that the Florida prison system is an extraordinarily brutal and corrupt one. You know, as we sit here right now, a prisoner named Darren Rainey, he was burned to death by Florida prison guards. No one was charged in his murder. The Human Rights Defense Center, the organization publishes our magazine, we're suing on behalf of the estate of Vincent Gaines. He was a prisoner who was starved. He was a mentally ill prisoner who was starved to death. And again, no one's been charged in his starvation murder. So, you know, so I mean, this is the type of prison system that we're talking about. You know, not surprisingly, they don't want, you know, they don't want prisoners in their captivity to read about the news that affects them and you know, is about their lives and everything else. And, you know, and it's one of the things I have to say is that, you know, I get a little troubled when I, you know, read about, you know, supposed fake news. And I can say that in 28 years of publishing, no one's ever claimed anything we've ever published isn't true. But it's also the thing, too, when the very government officials that are being criticized for their myriad human rights violations and abuses and corruption, the unilateral power to order the censorship of the publications and keep it from reaching the population that's affected. And, you know, most of the time the federal judiciary has been responsive to, you know, to the First Amendment, and, you know, they've acted to protect our First Amendment rights. And this is kind of the egregious failure where they didn't.
Well, keep up the fight. Kevin, you've been busy writing, too, about prison conditions. You recently had a piece in Shadowproof entitled Incarcerated Black Transgender Woman Who Survived Rape and Box Cutter Attacks Sues California Prison Employees. Can you tell us about that case?
Yeah, I just think this is a really critical example of what transgender prisoners experience. You know, I think I talked to the attorney that's bringing this case, and they definitely view this as representative of the sort of brutality that transgender prisoners can experience. And then I think double, not only is she transgender, but she's black, so you have that working against her. So just very quickly, in California, this woman was incarcerated, and at first she was beaten by guards. And then when she was first incarcerated in 2015, she was imprisoned with someone who was abusive. And a transgender person had to, who was a leader in the prison, got her out for a few days, but then she ended up back. And again, she's in a men's prison. She's not in a women's facility. So she was with this individual, and that individual raped her. And she had severe anal fissures as a result, but the prison facility would not give her any medical treatment. She tried to get them to investigate, but of course they don't take this seriously, and they don't really do anything more than a cursory investigation, which they might be required to put on their books. She was transferred around to various facilities. In the duration of her time in prison after this, you know, all of these complaints and everything, she gets put into solitary confinement because that is how the authorities decide
yep.
to manage her
Every time.
A transgender prisoner. And basically, she gets penalized because of her her orientation. They say that she's making a choice to represent as a woman. And so then they say, because you are under threat for assault, because you're a vulnerable person in this facility, we need to put you in solitary confinement. Anyway, she was transferred, to wrap this up, she was transferred to a facility, the California Medical Facility. And while she was there, she was incarcerated with an ex-boyfriend who came and threatened her life and said, if you don't leave your wife, I am going to kill you. She complained to one of the officers working in the prison, but they didn't care. And it was only a few days later that she was attacked with a box cutter. She had her face, her neck, her ear was cut so badly that her right ear was like dangling off the side of her head. She was bleeding profusely. And the people who were there in the dining hall when this happened just let it unfold. And then when she threw her body on an officer to get them to do something to save her, she was thrown into handcuffs. She was taken for interrogation. They got in the way of medical staff as she's bleeding and asked her about what was going on and insisted that they perform the interrogation while emergency medical personnel were trying to help her. And then eventually when they were done, she did get transferred to a hospital, but she had all of this happen. She's lost 60% hearing in her right ear. And also because of all of this, she was getting something called, she was getting these rules violation reports on her record, these RVRs, they were retaliation. And because they're on her record, she came up for parole and was not released from custody. So this is just representative of what transgender prisoners go through, but I think she's a critical case at the moment, or you know, someone that you can bring up and try to bring attention to the fact that, in particular, if we're talking generically about the United States, there are places like California that still have not implemented the standards for the Prison Rape Elimination Act that were passed in 2003. And this is what her attorney really called attention to, is that they aren't doing anything to protect these people who are transgender prisoners.
And let me add a couple of points, too, that you make in this outstanding article. This event happened in early 2015, okay? Between 2015 and late 2018, she spent 9 months in solitary confinement. They said for her own protection. We all know it was for punishment. But we're talking about just under 4 years. When they finally answered her question, she was asking for an update on the investigation. When they finally answered her, almost 4 years after the incident, she was told that the case was closed 1 or 2 days after she was attacked. So there never was any investigation. The punishment was of her, not of her attackers.
Yeah, exactly right. And these officers who are involved, you know, it's very clear that they're putting her into further harm because she's challenging them. And you have basically, you know, the facility where she was attacked by correctional officers, a state facility, she gets transferred back to it, which should never happen. And again, constantly this confining her with someone who is abusive and who is threatening her and making her fear for her life is the opposite. And then they also, you know, one of the things I learned from the story that, you know, maybe Paul can add some light to if he wants to, but I was not familiar with this thing called the sensitive needs yards in California, which is going to be shut down, it sounds like, because it's not actually effective. It's become harder. It's supposed to protect people who are under threat from gangs, disgraced cops that would be killed in prison, sex offenders, people like that. But actually what they found is in California, it grew so big in the facilities, and they also weren't able to prevent the problems of general population from spreading into the sensitive need yards. And so it just defeats the purpose of even having this as a part. But, you know, I asked her attorney, what's going to happen to her if she's still in prison and they phase out the sensitive need yards? I think that really is a critical question. And the CDCR doesn't actually know, the California prison system doesn't know. And I think what happens is you just have transgender people by default. If they're not allowed to be in women's prisons, you just by default put them in solitary confinement and punish them for being transgender.
We're speaking with Kevin Gastala and Paul Wright. Kevin joins us from Chicago. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And Paul joins us from Lake Worth, Florida. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Guys, I'd like to go to the next story we have on our list here. It's something that when I read in the Washington Post, it absolutely infuriated me. It's entitled "Let Them Eat Steak." This is disgraceful, infuriating coverage of federal prisoners eating steak one day a year. And the comment section in the Washington Post was just, I couldn't read any more of it. It was just so hate-filled and so angry. The truth is, one day a year in the federal prison system, prisoners are fed, I'm using air quotes, steak. It's not really steak. It's just a brown glob of gristle and fat. It's not even human-grade meat. And, you know, most of these guys have been in prison for years. They haven't seen a steak. And so you gobble it down. Well, in the press, it says that they had steak and mashed potatoes and green beans and cobbler and blah, 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 blah. None of this is human grade food. This is all garbage that can't be sold to the public in stores because it doesn't meet the minimum federal requirements for, you know, nutrition and cleanliness and whatever else. I've talked on this show about my first full day in prison. It was fish day. It was a Friday. And the boxes of fish were stamped "Not for human consumption, feed use only." And that's what they were feeding us for lunch. And they fed us that for lunch every single Friday. They're still doing it every single Friday. Anyway, Paul, let's talk about this so-called steak dinner.
Well, you know, I think that a lot of this is also, I think, the dehumanization of prisoners and that. And I think the notion, you know, I think this also needs to be put against the backdrop of, due to the federal government shutdown, federal prison guards are complaining about not being paid. And so I think this is the whole thing of, well, we're not getting paid, but in the meantime, prisoners are quote, eating steak. And, you know, and it's funny because, you know, I read the article and I was thinking, you know, gosh, I was in prison for 17 years. I don't recall being fed steak at all, but maybe things really are that much better in the federal prison system. And I think the other one, too, is they also said that the prisoners are also being fed Cornish hens.
Yes, once a year we got a Cornish hen that was disgusting, and I sold mine for a book of stamps.
Yeah, and I think that's my recollection of the Cornish hens when I was in prison was, I think these were like, you know, the mutant chickens that didn't really grow that well or
that's
something.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, there's also jokes about how bad prison food is. And you know, and I think that, you know, like all joking aside, I think that one of the things is we've seen the steady deterioration in the quality and the quantity of food that prisoners are fed. Just in the time period I was in prison, you know, there's a switch from mediocre and low quality food in 1987, by the end of the 90s, had become processed, pretty much mostly starch and carbohydrates, factory produced food. And, you know, there's been, and in a lot of parts of the country, you know, prisoners go for literally years without eating fresh fruit or fresh vegetables at all. To then see this thing that the prison guards union is trumpeting that, you know, prisoners are being fed steak while the guards are working without pay, you know, I think that's just kind of one of those propaganda spin things of, you know, at best a half-truth, because I think, as you mentioned before the show, John, you know, your time in federal prison, it doesn't remind you of, you know, going to Ruth Chris's steakhouse or anything.
And if I could interrupt you, another thing, too, is in the last government shutdown, there was a piece on CBS News saying, look at this, the prison guards aren't getting paid, but the prisoners are getting paid. This is what's wrong with our country. Without telling people that the money that prisoners are paid, and in my case, I made 40 cents a month for being a janitor in the chapel, that comes from prisoner money. When you buy something in the commissary, the prices are marked up and the profits are used to pay prisoners and to buy gym equipment and basketballs and what have you. None of that money, not one single cent of that money, comes from the American taxpayer.
And I think that's also the thing, too, is, you know, it's also worth noting that the wages are slave wages, you know, and I think that's the huge difference, is that, you know, prisoners are paid slave wages if they're paid at all. And in fact, the government doesn't even call them wages. They call it a gratuity. Lest they, you know, prisoners get the notion that they should be entitled to the minimum wage or any type of worker protection or anything like that.
I'd like to quickly point out that the person who was quoted as driving all of these stories was a union leader, Joe Royaz, who did fine work. It appears whoever was doing his PR did a very good job of pitching him to all these outlets, because he's the source for this story in not only the Washington Post, but these other outlets that picked up this prisoners are eating steak during the shutdown story. But what it made very abundantly clear is something we've called attention to before on this program, which is these outlets don't have sources inside prisons to talk to. I mean, you don't find in any of these stories anyone contacting inmates to talk about what we are saying here about the nature of food. I mean, both of you have talked about what a Cornish hen would actually be like, what steak would be like. If they're eating chicken wings, it's not from Popeyes. It's got to be much worse than that.
So true. Yes.
I think that's important to say. I think also the reaction to this is important to quickly just be clear about, because the way people, if you support this kinds of journalism, then what you're essentially saying is nobody in prison should eat real or authentic food. I mean, basically people are getting upset that one day of the year you might have a holiday meal that approaches something close to real food. And I mean, as you're making clear, it's not even close. But what we're saying is it's okay if people are eating garbage food on a daily basis and they're offended if prisoners would eat anything less than, or I mean, anything more than garbage food.
That's the voice of Kevin Gastala. We're talking to Kevin and Paul Wright, as we do every Thursday in this segment about the U.S. criminal justice system. The name of our segment is Criminal Injustice, because that is the character of the criminal justice system in the United States. We have a curtain of silence, and it goes both ways. As we started this program, John, and as Paul Wright was discussing Prison Legal News' legal efforts, prisoners are not entitled to learn and get information from the outside. And people on the outside of the prisons are forbidden from learning what the prisoners actually think and feel. And of course, there's no communication. So this curtain of silence, which I think is one of the reasons why it's so important what Shadow Proof is doing, what Paul Wright and Prison Legal News is doing, what we're trying to do every week, is we're trying to rip down the curtain of silence. Because the curtain of silence has deadly consequences for prisoners. And it's a stain. It's one of the worst stains on society. And again, how do prisoners succeed in achieving even basic human rights? Basic human rights. Again, denied the First Amendment right, the right to speak or the right to receive information, which is criminal in and of itself, a violation of, well, at least what the Constitution pretends it's about. Kevin, Shadow Proof has an important article, though. Federal court will appoint monitor to ensure Illinois prisoners have basic health care. Again, Shadow Proof and Prison Legal News, sites that people should go to learn about that which the mainstream media has no sources for and has no desire or no interest in covering. Talk about this story.
Yeah, so quickly, this is an update to something we talked about weeks ago. The outcome here is what I think prisoners and the Uptown People's Law Center and other attorneys that were pushing for this, they're pleased that there's going to be a federal court appointing a monitor that's going to be looking over the facilities in the Illinois correctional system to basically, maybe they'll have basic health care now. I mean, that's an incredible thing for us to say on this show, that before that, they did not even have the most basic level of health care. But now there's an opening, there's a possibility that they could get some basic health care. And by basic health care, I mean there is going to be a new process whereby people who are doctors and nurses might actually have to have doctorates, have legitimate medical degrees to be practicing medicine in these facilities because they weren't qualified before, and that was resulting in risks of death, and people were going through lots of pain and suffering. So, I mean, I think, again, what you're talking about here about how do prisoners get human rights, how do they just be treated with basic decency? I mean, maybe we might get closer. There's a lot of work to be done, but this is a good beginning to maybe getting some basic health care in Illinois.
You know, I want to add something, too. This is such a big deal. This is so important. I was talking to a guy who happens to be the great-grandson of Sitting Bull. He's a Native American activist. Earlier in his life, he got himself into trouble on the reservation with drugs. He was caught importing some drugs across the border from Canada and was sentenced to 20 years in a state prison in South Dakota. So he had been in prison for a couple of years. He developed severe pain in his legs and he kept going to medical. And you know where the story is going because we've told variations of it a million times. He kept going to medical. They kept giving him aspirin and sending him back. It got to the point where he couldn't walk. It turned out he had cancer. He had bone cancer in both of his legs. They had to remove both of his legs. And he was confined to a wheelchair for the next 16 years of his prison sentence. He just got out about 2 years ago, now confined to a wheelchair for the rest of his life. And we were talking because he wanted to know how he could get involved in this kind of advocacy for prison health care. That kind of thing happens every day in America.
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was going to say is that one of the things that's really pathetic is the fact that, you know, by all accounts, health care in all of our prisons is terrible. And for the federal prison system, it's abysmal. And the difference is that difficult and expensive as these cases are, occasionally groups of nonprofit lawyers are and have been able to tackle these cases at the state level, but basically no one's been able to tackle it against the federal government. And recently, I think it was last year, the Bureau of Prisons settled a case against the ADX Supermax where basically they've been warehousing severely mentally ill prisoners for literally decades, prisoners that were mutilating themselves, killing themselves, and rather than treating their mental illness, they're locking them in cages for years and decades on end. And you know, and I think that, you know, where there's all this talk about the government shutdown and well, the guards aren't being paid, it's kind of like, well, what are they being paid to do? Because provide adequate medical care to federal prisoners is not high on the list, and that's one of the things that our intakes of the letters that we get here at the Human Rights Defense Center, not a week goes by that we don't get a number of letters from Bureau of Prisons prisoners talking about just the horrific medical care they're getting, or more importantly, the medical care they're not getting. And, you know, and Congress has been, which supposedly has oversight over the Bureau of Prisons, they've been totally AWOL on this for pretty much their entire existence. They've shown no interest at all in ensuring that prisoners receive adequate medical care. And, you know, there's this, and I think this goes to point to the crisis of the lack of interest in providing prisoners with medical care. One story that we didn't get to a few weeks ago was the story out of Texas, where finally, after a media expose by the Houston Chronicle, the Texas prison system was going to give prisoners without teeth dentures. And for apparently years, the Texas prison system's position was that you don't need teeth. If you've had your teeth removed, you don't need teeth to eat, which is, you know, just on its face bizarre. And they treated dentures as some type of luxury item.
Well, I'll tell you what, let me interrupt you on that point. I cracked a tooth when I was in prison, and I went to see the dentist who was in once a week on Thursdays, and he patched it up temporarily. He asked me first how long my sentence was, and I said it was 2.5 years, and I had about a year to go. And he said, I'm going to patch it up as soon as you get out. Go to your regular dentist and he'll fix it permanently. And I said, what about all these other guys who are in here for 10, 15, 20 years?
They only do extraction.
Yeah, he said, all I do all day long is pull teeth out. That's it.
Yeah, there's no bridges, there's no crowns, there's no root canals. It's just extract, extract, extract. And I think that the lack of dental care in our country's prisons, I think, is, you know, is quite the outrage, especially when dental care has been linked to, you know, so many other health conditions, from, you know, heart attacks to coronary disease and a lot of other things.
And oral cancer.
And oral cancer, throat cancer, you know, things like that. But I think this is just kind of almost the overall dehumanization, brutalization of our nation's prison population, where they aren't viewed as a population of people that are entitled to just basic things like fundamental health care.
Kevin, we've got about 2 minutes left. I want to talk real quickly about this case in South Carolina where some deputies were transporting two female prisoners during a period of storms and some flooding. They drove into standing water. It was a flash flood. The car began to be swept away. The deputies got out. They just left the women. The car was carried away and the women drowned. Well, now those deputies are going to face charges. Go ahead.
Yeah, they're going to face charges for reckless homicide and involuntary manslaughter. So it's not murder. It's not second degree murder. I mean, there probably wasn't any premeditation on the parts of wanting to kill them, but they did do harm to these women and they deserve to be held accountable for what they did. And I think this does resolve a key issue, which was, were they going to have to go to court at all and defend their actions? Because, you know, they did what they could to save themselves. They didn't do anything to save the prisoners that they were transporting. I mean, it again speaks to the dehumanization of prisoners. And the fact that they were even out, I don't know that we even have a clear articulation of that makes any sense as to why they were out driving around as the hurricane was bearing upon South Carolina. And even that basic detail, they should have to give that answer. And I'm glad that they're going to have to do more. They're not only going to have to answer for why they were out, but they're also going to have to defend their actions in a court of law.
Yeah, and that's very, very unusual. They were transporting these women from a hospital to a prison facility, and they've never explained why they had to do that at the height of a hurricane. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. Kevin's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul's also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. We talk to them every Thursday, so be sure to tune in again. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.